The sounds of American radio on the early afternoon of December 7, 1941. That's our focus on this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David McKenzie.
Where were you on the afternoon of December 7, 1941? If your name is Michel Piastro, you were at Carnegie Hall tightening the strings of your violin for the Sunday afternoon performance. If you are Gerald Nye, you are addressing 2,200 America Firsters in Pittsburgh. If your name is Saburo Caruso, you are waiting in the outer office of Cordell Hull. If you are a sailor named Tomish at a place called Pearl Harbor, you and 2,116 of your buddies will be dead when the day is done.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
That is how many Americans falsely recall how they heard about the entrance of the United States into the Second World War that late autumn Sunday. What you just heard from CBS newsman John Daly was actually a recreation specifically cut for an Edward R. Murrow record album titled I Can Hear It Now. Daly's words actually came from a record of his announcing the death of President Roosevelt in 1945 and the studio recreation some years after that, spliced together. The actual sounds of the news that day were a little different. First, on New York City station WOR, an All-American football conference game between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Yankees was underway when this interruption was made.
It's a long one down to around the 3-yard line. Ward Cup takes it, cutting up to his left. He's over the 10. Nice block there by Lehman. Cup's still going. He's up to the 25. And now he's hit and hit hard about the 27-yard line. Bruiser Kennard made the tackle.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
Meanwhile, at 2:29 Eastern Time, the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company was wrapping its broadcast of music by band leader Sammy Kaye.
It has been the pleasure of the National Broadcasting Company to bring you Sammy Kaye's Sunday Serenade, featuring his world-famed swing and sway music. The poem read by Sammy Kaye was When We're Apart by Wilson Darren. Today's broadcast has come to you from our studios in Radio City, New York.
From the NBC newsroom in New York, President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked the Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. I'll repeat that. President Roosevelt says that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air. This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York.
Then, at 2:30 on CBS, a news broadcast anchored by John Charles Daly was just beginning.
The World Today. By shortwave radio, Columbia now brings you reports from its foreign correspondents overseas with summaries of the latest world news presented over these stations by Golden Eagle Gasoline. Go ahead, New York.
The details are not available. They will be in a few minutes. The White House is now giving out a statement. The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. The president's brief statement was read to reporters by Stephen Early, the president's secretary. A Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor naturally would mean war. Such an attack would naturally bring a counterattack. And hostilities of this kind would naturally mean that the president would ask Congress for a declaration of war. There is no doubt from the temper of Congress that such a declaration would be granted. This morning, Secretary Hull talked with the secretaries of war and of the Navy. Now the two special Japanese envoys, Admiral Nomura and Special Envoy Caruso, are at the State Department, engaged in conference with Secretary of State Hull. Their appearance at the State Department on this Sunday afternoon emphasizes the gravity of the Far Eastern situation where hostilities now seem to be actually opening over the whole South Pacific. Even more important than the visit of Tokyo's diplomats is this news which comes from Pearl Harbor and the news which comes from South Asia. Whatever the diplomats from Tokyo or the cabinet in Tokyo may be saying, there is a conviction in official quarters here that Japan has now cast the die. All the bits of information which came to the State Department and the Navy yesterday and today indicated that Japanese transports containing troops were steaming into the Gulf of Thailand. Japanese warships were providing a heavy escort. Having rounded the southernmost point of French Indochina, the convoy had as its only obvious destination Bangkok, the capital of Thailand. It was on the basis of this information that President Roosevelt sent to Emperor Hirohito of Japan his personal message last night, a message which appealed to the Mikado for restraint and peace. It seemed to be a final plea from the United States. And if the activities today are substantiated, it is a final plea. For if Japanese troops attempt to capture Bangkok or attack Pearl Harbor, the balance, the delicate balance, which has maintained peace in South Asia, is destroyed. The four powers, the United States, Britain, the Dutch East Indies, and Australia, have given Japan ample warning that invasion of Thailand would mean counteraction by the associated powers. These Japanese envoys, Nomura and Kurusu, requested the appointment with Mr. Hull today. The engagement was set for 1:45 p.m., They arrived some minutes late and in turn were kept waiting before the door to Mr. Hull's office was opened to them at 2:20. In the meantime, the president had prepared the statement which announced that Japan was attacking Pearl Harbor from the air. It is possible that the Tokyo diplomats wanted again to assure the State Department that the reports of Japanese troop movements in French Indochina were exaggerated. They did that once before on instructions from Tokyo when the president propounded his question about those movements last Tuesday. At that time, Tokyo replied that the movements were in North Indochina to offset Chinese movements on the Indochina border. The specific information of the State Department now and then was that the bulk of the Japanese troops were being moved to South Indochina, where they were in a better position to threaten Thailand. The president's plea to Emperor Hirohito was also supported by a note of warning. The warning is supported by developments and preparations in this capital. The meeting between Secretary Hull and the Secretaries of War and Navy this morning was an example of the plans that are being laid. It would be a mistake for Japan to believe that these preparations are any kind of bluff. Although officials in Washington are silent on what would be the definite consequences of a Japanese attack on Hawaii or an attack on Thailand, there are indications of what is being considered and the steps which may be taken this very afternoon. The first would be a severance of diplomatic relations with Tokyo. An immediate naval blockade in which the American Navy would take a leading part, along with British units, is the other probability. Both these steps could be taken by the president on his own executive authority. But an effective naval blockade, of course, could not continue long without hostilities. As a matter of fact, according to the president's announcement, those hostilities are already underway with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And just now comes the word from the president's office that a second air attack has been reported on Army and Navy bases in Manila. Thus, we have official announcements from the White House that Japanese airplanes have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii and have now attacked Army and Navy bases in Manila. We return you now to New York and we'll give you later information as it comes along from the White House. Return you now to New York.
London, in many respects, has correlated its moves in the Far Eastern situation with the progress of the American-Japanese discussions in Washington. Australia and Singapore and other Crown colonies have been made ready for any eventuality, and a Far Eastern fleet has been created, headed by the 35,000-ton Prince of Wales. For a direct report on British reaction to the latest moves in the Near East and the Far East, Bob Trout is standing by in the British capital. Go ahead, London.
London heard its first news of the attacks on Hawaii and the Philippines from John Charles Daly in New York just a few moments ago. The report had not arrived in London before this Columbia program began. It is, of course, too early to give you any reaction, but as you know, the British government made plain what would happen if America became involved in war with Japan some days ago. We did get earlier that official report from Singapore that British air reconnaissance in the South China Seas had confirmed the earlier reports of Japanese activities. Japanese naval vessels, including cruisers, seen off the southern tip of Indochina, steaming toward the northwest. That announcement backed up those earlier dispatches from Washington, telling of heavy Japanese troop concentrations in Indochina, both ashore and afloat. About the president's message to the Emperor of Japan, we heard nothing except the announcement that a message had been sent. Today's Libyan communique says that yesterday an important battle was joined southeast of Tobruk, where the main German tank forces have concentrated since breaking through the Tobruk corridor. These past few days, London newspapers have been full of discussions about Libya. Arguments about the caliber of guns and the thickness of tank armor, about tank speed versus tank weight, about the airplane as compared to the anti-tank gun as weapons of destruction against enemy tanks. Through these lengthy articles, there has run as the theme the conviction that Britain must counter the enemy's modern war technique with methods even more modern. Now, not all this recent discussion is adversely critical. Some think that the British armed forces have already learned a lot from hard experience in this war, but there are complaints that, for example, while British tanks in the desert lay up at night like a defensive circle of covered wagons out west, the desert darkness is lit up with the flares of the panzer repair squads patching up damaged German tanks for the next day's battle. It is interesting that a great deal of this discussion centers on the employment of air power. In the Libyan fighting, the Royal Air Force has played a larger part than in any previous conflict. But many military writers are saying that British planes still do not play the same integral part in a tank battle that the German planes do. A typical comment is this from last night's Standard. Nobody in his senses would argue that the fleet should be without its own fleet air arm. So why do we send our soldiers out to fight without the same coordinated weapon? That is some of London's reaction to the Battle of Libya. Later, I believe, we shall hear a report on this broadcast direct from Cairo. The British are disappointed about the recent experience of Dr. Julian Huxley in the United States. Just yesterday, the latest issue of The Spectator came out with some observations about British speakers in America. It said that Dr. Huxley is a speaker who will soon wear down any suspicion of propagandism. The British people I've met in London do not seem to think much of propaganda anyway. They think Britain's cause is good enough to stand on its own feet without any trimmings. They're more interested in the enemy's propaganda, which frequently causes amusement in London. German claims are printed in London newspapers, and the airwaves over Britain are full of German radio programs. Listeners can tune in whenever they feel like it. A listener with a powerful receiving set soon discovers that the German radio speakers have one story to broadcast to one country and another quite different story to put out someplace else. Last night, for example, the German-controlled Norwegian radio announced that the United States Army has become converted to communism, at least to the extent of installing political commissars. Now, in case you had not heard that the United States Army is now being run by political commissars, I thought I'd pass it along, for that's what Norwegians were told last night. I return you now to Columbia in New York.
To recapitulate, the White House reported today Japanese air attacks on the Hawaiian Islands and Manila in the Philippines. Now, following a week in which the North African campaign has seen only local actions and a regrouping of forces by both sides, Bob Trout reported, as he told you just a few moments ago, that there is a resumption of hostilities on a major scale. These reports from North Africa are interesting in the North African campaign, but of course the Far East still holds the center of the stage and will probably for some time. Here in the studio with me is Major George Fielding Elliott, Columbia's military expert, who will analyze now these latest developments in the Far East. Major Elliott.
The Japanese appear to be taking the offensive in an effort to delay and impede American operations in the Far East. Apparently confronted with a situation in which there was no escape except war, the Japanese have attacked the main American naval base in the Pacific at Pearl Harbor on the island of Oahu in the Hawaiian Islands. This attack is by air and can only come from aircraft carriers, since the Japanese do not have any bases close enough to the Hawaiian Islands from which to launch land-based aircraft. This is a very great risk for the Japanese to place aircraft carriers within reach of the very powerful naval patrol bombers and the long-range army bombers on the island of Oahu. It is a risk which would only be assumed as a very desperate measure, one which may well result in the loss of the carriers that are making the attack, but may also gain for the Japanese important time to carry out operations in the Far East because of the damage that they may inflict on the naval base and shipping in Oahu, and thus delay the proceeding of the United States Pacific Fleet to the Western Pacific. That is probably the Japanese object, and we don't know yet what success they've had in carrying it out. A Japanese air attack is also being made on Army and Navy installations at Manila in the Philippines. Manila and its surrounding area is also of military importance, but it's far less formidable in the character of its defenses than is the island of Oahu, and the Japanese, consequently, have a greater chance of getting away with the forces that they've have sent there to make these attacks. The Japanese have probably 7 aircraft carriers in commission and an unknown number of carriers converted from merchant vessels. There are at least 3 or 4 of these, and perhaps more, with comparatively small numbers of aircraft, but together they make a formidable concentration, and they can operate about 20 aircraft from these converted carriers and anywhere from 30 to 50 aircraft from their larger carriers. These would include both scouting and bombing aircraft as well as fighters to protect the carriers, but in a case like this, a desperate forlorn hope business, they've probably concentrated on bombers and put every bomber on board the carriers that they will handle. They're expecting to take heavy losses, and these losses may be expected. The question is how much delay they have purchased for the carriers that they have risked. Whether there will be an actual attempt at a Japanese landing on the island of Luzon to back up the air attack on Manila is not known. It is extremely unlikely that there will be any attempt at a Japanese landing on the island of Oahu in the Hawaiian Islands. It is hardly probable that a Japanese expedition carrying troops in sufficient numbers to attack Oahu with any hope of success could have proceeded across the Pacific without some notice of it being had by our naval authorities. Consequently, it seems likely that this is an air attack and purely a delaying action on Oahu only, but the attack on Manila may be one of more formidable proportions and may include troops. The Japanese policy apparently has been to delay as long as possible in the on the diplomatic front and to carry on their military preparations in the meanwhile, gaining as much time as they could. We've pointed out again and again in the course of these broadcasts that the Japanese were gaining time on the diplomatic front in order to improve their fighting chances, and this certainly is borne out by what has now happened. We just had a United Press flash. Oahu Island was attacked today by unidentified airplanes. That's another flash on the Japanese air attacks on Hawaii. Remember that Oahu is the military and political center of the Hawaiian group. The island itself is one of the most formidable maritime fortresses in the world. Heavy guns defend the ports of Pearl Harbor and Honolulu. Railway guns on tracks around the islands are able to be moved swiftly to any point. There is a very strong garrison, which even a year or two ago numbered about 25,000 troops and probably now has been very considerably increased. There are powerful naval and army air forces on the island, including some of the Army's longest-range bombers, 4-engine bombers based on Hickam Field, so that any appearance of any Japanese force in the neighborhood is likely to suffer very severely as soon as they can be located by these long-range bombers.
Continuing on the Far Eastern situation, this time we go abroad to get a report direct from the danger zone, from Manila in the Philippines, which has been attacked, as we have told you. CBS correspondent Ford Wilkins has watched Manila get ready for this attack. And now, for the report of Ford Wilkins, direct from Manila, go ahead, Manila.
Thank you. The danger of panic is also great. With the bulk of the population shifted, there is sufficient shelter and protection to make the city safe enough for those who remain. Whether war comes or not, the government is seriously considering closing the schools and moving the children to evacuation centers where schools may be set up. One immediate government problem is to raise some $15 million to carry on. The original emergency fund is nearly exhausted. Manila's problems are reflected throughout the country, and they are acute in places which are considered danger zones. They are likewise reflected throughout this whole Pacific area where war threatens. Hong Kong has mobilized completely and called out volunteers. Singapore's fighting forces are standing by, ready for anything. In Java, they have been preparing for many months. In Thai, the little buffer state between French Indochina and Burma, the tension reaches its highest point. Japanese troops are crowding it on the east, and a large movement of Japanese ships accompanied by cruisers has been spotted by British patrol flyers from Singapore, steaming up the Gulf of Siam towards Bangkok. Across the China Sea from the Philippines,
due to line troubles beyond. We return you now to CBS in New York.
Broadcast, a description of the attack made upon Manila. To carry on with the subject that he started to talk about, the sighting of transporters, or rather transports and cruisers, believed Japanese in the Gulf of Siam, moving towards Thailand, there is news that comes also from our correspondent in Singapore. He says that there are strongest indications there that Japan was about to launch a joint naval and land attack upon Thailand with the immediate aim of capturing the capital, Bangkok. Brown confirms the earlier report of Japanese merchant and naval ships sighted off Point de Camoy at the southern tip of Indochina and believed to have come from Saigon and Cameron Bay. Major Elliott is still here in the studio beside us, and this report raises a point which I think perhaps he may be able to clear up for us. Major Elliott, do you think that this attack upon Manila and the attacks upon the Hawaiian Islands may be to cover the attacks to be made by these transports and cruisers sailing up into the Bay of Siam and supposedly sailing up there to attack Bangkok?
I think very likely that's the case, Mr. Daly. The Japanese would fear, above everything else, the arrival of the United States Pacific Fleet in those waters. When that got there, if Manila was still open to it, it would be able to cut the line of communications between Japan, between the home bases in Japan, upon which everything depends, and the Japanese armies in Indochina, which have no land connections at all with the main Japanese armies in China. So that the attack on Pearl Harbor is undoubtedly intended to delay the arrival of the Pacific Fleet by doing what damage is possible. And if the carriers that make it are sacrificed, why, that's just too bad.
Major Elliott, Cecil Brown, reporting from Singapore, also described British naval patrols as very active, and all units of the British Far Eastern Fleet, recently bolstered by the Prince of Wales, one of Britain's newest and biggest battleships, ready for instant action. Do you think that the units of the British fleet, which are now based at Singapore and which are cruising in the immediate area of the Gulf of Siam, will be sufficiently strong to at least hold off that attack of the Japanese, which is reportedly headed for Bangkok?
Well, so far, only Japanese cruisers have been reported in the Gulf of Siam, and they would be likely to be cut off by British battleships operating from Singapore. But under the circumstances, one would be inclined to believe that the main Japanese battle fleet may be somewhere in the vicinity with the purpose of perhaps trying in turn to cut the British off if they attack the Japanese concentrations in the Gulf of Siam, hoping that these Japanese ships would be able to get back toward their home bases before the American Pacific Fleet would arrive, and in turn there is the factor of the unknown effect as yet of the Japanese air attacks on Pearl Harbor, which are intended to delay the movements of the Pacific Fleet.
Well, have you any information, Major, on the British shore defenses in Sarawak and North Borneo? Do you think they can make any great difference in this action that seems to be pending in the Gulf of Siam?
I think very likely that there are air bases there of considerable capacity. There was nothing 2 years ago in North Borneo and Sarawak, but the British have been working lately around the island of Labuan and also on the shore, both in Sarawak and farther north in the British Crown Colony of British North Borneo, and they probably have increased the air capacity over there very considerably. There have also been reports that heavy guns have been mounted at one or two ports along that coast with a view to establishing harbor defenses to protect them against an immediate Japanese attack. However, the Japanese might attempt a landing in Borneo, and if they are going all out on this desperate basis that they seem to be, they very likely will try to eliminate these air bases.
Well, now, Major, we have here a bulletin that has just come in which says that policemen and firemen were ordered in a radio broadcast to go to Army and Navy posts immediately at Honolulu. And it brings up the question
of the distance between Hawaii and Japan, which, if I remember correctly, is somewhere around 3,800 miles. Would that indicate that the Japanese attacks upon Oahu were made from carriers, necessarily, or are there Japanese-mandated islands which would be sufficiently well-developed to house either seaplanes or shore-based aircraft?
No, there's nothing that's near enough to direct an attack of any force. The attack must have been made from carriers. But the nearest Japanese possessions in the Marshall Islands are so far from Honolulu that it's impossible to direct any serious air attack. Long-range flying boats might do something, but the Japanese would have no reason to do that. That would be merely a pinprick, and it would have no serious effect. If the Japanese are attacking Hawaii, they're attacking it with a purpose of producing some substantial military effect, and the number of the fire effect that could be produced by what few long-range flying boats could operate from Jesuit and the Marshalls is just not sufficient for the purpose.
Well, can you perhaps give us some light on the reason why the Japanese used even a small part of their forces for an attack on Hawaii rather than concentrating all of their strength on Cavite in the Philippines, which might, since it's so much closer to Japan, it would seem at least be a more important point of attack?
Because the fleet's in Hawaii, and they hope to be able to damage the vessels in harbor and the installations at Pearl Harbor to such an extent that they can delay the eastward movement of the fleet, which, after all, is dependent on its supplies for the support of Pearl Harbor as a base. The more damage they can do to the base and to the ships that are still there, of course, we don't know the exact disposition of the American fleet, the more they can delay any vigorous action by the United States fleet in the Western Pacific because of the distances and the supply problem. Incidentally, the movement of policemen and firemen to important posts in Honolulu suggests the possibility that there may be some sort of a rising among the Japanese population of those islands. There are 150,000 Japanese live in the Hawaiian Islands, and some of them may be inclined to make trouble. Our authorities are supposed to have had this problem very well in hand, and we don't know yet, of course, whether anything of the sort is true or not.
Thank you very much, Major Elliott. And now, Elmer Davis, CBS News analyst, who was hurriedly called into our 17th floor studios as news of this new break in the Far Eastern situation came in, is ready to analyze to some extent the political effects of this latest move by Japan. Elmer Davis.
Well, the most interesting thing, Mr. Daly, is that it was a week ago yesterday that the Japanese said they wanted 2 weeks more for negotiation. It was obvious that they were allowing themselves a limit, hoping that our military and naval forces would take them seriously, which obviously, we presume at least, they have not done. Since they only actually wanted 1 week, it seems that our forces are probably ready in both, we hope at least, in both Hawaii and the Philippines. And consequently, the Japanese move is probably anticipated in those points. We just have a bulletin from London that President Roosevelt's announcement of Japanese air attacks on United States Pacific bases staggered London, which awaited fulfillment of Prime Minister Churchill's promise to declare war on Japan within the hour if she attacked the United States. Well, of course, the United States and Japan are not formally at war. However, it seems probable that in view of the Japanese attacks, this is only a question for the reassembling of Congress tomorrow, since if you have actually been attacked by the enemy, you can do but little else. Here in more detail, direct from the front, from Honolulu, the smoke of anti-aircraft guns rose over the Pearl Harbor Navy Yard. Heavy smoke also drifted up from Hickam Field in the Pearl Harbor area, apparently from fires. Witnesses said fires broke out on Ford Island. The Japanese attack was evidently well planned, and they seem to have aimed at the principal points that they should have attacked. And meanwhile, of course, President Roosevelt's message to the Emperor of Japan is one of the questions which has now passed into history. Ford Island is the Navy air base. Hickam Field is the Army air base. The Army bombing field. And it is apparent that the Japanese, who presumably attacked from carriers, as Major Elliott has pointed out, were trying to head off the reprisals from the Army and Navy bombers, which might possibly come back at the carriers from which the Japanese planes set off. This doesn't leave very much for Admiral Nomura and Mr. Kurusu to say in Washington. They have served their purpose, Mr. Kurusu particularly. It might be remarked, so far as Admiral Nomura is concerned, a man who has many friends in this country, who has long been well known here, that he is presumably the kind of Japanese with whom we could have got along in past times if his government had not been a government of a different sort. Admiral Nomura is a man who is well-known, as I say, and who is well-liked by many Americans, and he is a reminder that there is still a type of Japanese in Japan, although they have had but little to say about their government policy in the past 10 years, with whom we could get along if they were in power, and who are perhaps the best hope of eventual good relations between America and Japan. But something else will have to be done first. Another bulletin from Hawaii that the attack was made by 50 unidentified airplanes, and that the main targets appeared to be Hickman Field, the Army bombing field, and the Great Naval Base at Pearl Harbor. Several planes were shot down. This again, as I say, seems to reduce to futility all the diplomatic negotiations that were going on, but it seems probable that a statement of American policy and of the history of the recent negotiations is likely to be given out soon, which will show the efforts that our government has made to avert hostilities and to keep the Pacific question on a basis in which some peaceful settlement might still have been possible. Now it appears that the Japanese have positively rejected that. Perhaps only a faction of the Japanese, but the faction which is now controlling their army and their navy, and the faction which is in control of the government, so that that settlement of the issue is ruled out. It was said when General Tojo became premier that when we once had an army man at the head of the Japanese government, it would be possible to make an arrangement with them, because the army would no longer be in the background sabotaging any arrangement that might be made by civilian rulers of the country. The Japanese Army and Navy, of course, have a peculiarly powerful position inasmuch as they report directly to the emperor, and it was not possible, or at least has not been proved possible in the last 10 or 15 years, for any civilian government to follow policies which the Army and Navy disapproved. And the argument when General Tojo came in was that now at last we had one of the ruling clique in control of the government, and an agreement made with him was something that would stick. But it appears that this particular ruling clique had no idea of making any agreement at all, that the sole purpose in their negotiations at Washington was to gain time and to endeavor to throw American military and naval forces off guard, an endeavor which we hope has not been successful, so that they might make their attacks and head off American military and naval operations which might constrict Japanese operations in the Far East.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. We have been on the telephone with our station in KGMB, which is in Honolulu, and they report to us that the attacking planes number between 50 and 100, that the air raid is still on, and that the anti-aircraft fire can be heard in a steady drone as the attacking planes come in. As Mr. Davis told you, we received a bulletin just a little while ago which reported that there have been some of these, what Manila Corps, or rather Honolulu calls unidentified planes, shot down. And this latest report now from KGMB is all that we have to the moment. We will continue to receive reports from there, also from Washington, on the developments in our relations with Japan, the relations which will tell very shortly the story of what is to happen in the months that are to come. And Columbia will bring you important news bulletins during the broadcast of the New York Philharmonic Society, which follows this program, and will also bring you a summary of all developments at the intermission time. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The next program on the CBS schedule was the weekly New York Philharmonic Concert. Some alert engineer at WCCO Minneapolis made sure to get that broadcast down on transcription discs, of which these excerpts were taken.
Here is a flash just received in our newsroom. Dateline, Washington. United States Army transport carrying lumber was torpedoed 1,300 miles west of San Francisco. Details on this news and other news that has been coming in on the Far East situation will be given to you at approximately 3:35 during the intermission of the New York Philharmonic Concert. We return you now to the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. Thank you.
The Symphony No. 1 in F minor by the modern Russian composer Shostakovich performed as the opening work on this afternoon's Philharmonic program, Artur Rudzinski conducting. Japan has attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and Manila, the Philippine Islands, from the air. The attack is developing. Today, Dean Taylor's usual commentary will be replaced by a further report on the Far Eastern situation. We pause now for 15 seconds. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is WCCO, studios in Minneapolis and St. Paul. The Twin City temperature, 37 degrees.
This is John Daly speaking from the CBS newsroom in New York. Here is the Far East situation as reported to this moment. The Japanese have attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and our defense facilities at Manila, capital of the Philippines. The first disclosure of this news was made by Presidential Secretary Stephen Early by telephone at approximately 2:25 in Washington. I read the text of this historic announcement at a little after 2:30. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor from the air, and all naval and military activities on the island of Oahu, the principal American base in the Hawaiian Islands. That was Secretary Early's message. Short while later, he dictated another message. A second air attack has been reported. This one has been made on the Army and Navy bases in Manila. And here's a last-minute Associated Press flash from Honolulu. A naval engagement is in progress off Honolulu with at least one black enemy aircraft carrier in action against the Pearl Harbor defenses. Secretary Early informed all correspondents and then rushed to the White House to be with President Roosevelt. As the announcement was made, the two Japanese envoys, Ambassador Nomura and Special Emissary Kurosu, were at the State Department. Columbia's correspondent in London, Bob Trout, heard the news for the first time from our report from New York. Up to that moment, or very shortly before then, the British capital had not been informed of the Japanese attack on the Hawaiian Islands and on Manila. In view of Prime Minister Churchill's recent pledge that a British declaration of war on Japan would follow almost immediately upon the outbreak of war between Japan and the United States, a British announcement is expected soon. Columbia was put on the air in CBS's regular 2:30 news program on Sunday afternoon from Manila. He was cut off the air suddenly while he was talking about air raid shelters, possibly because of censorship. In communication with Columbia's radio station, KGMB in Honolulu, we heard here in New York that the Pearl Harbor base had been attacked and anti-aircraft fire was heard. A telephone message to the United Press from Fort Schaefer in Hawaii said that 50 planes attacked the island of Oahu. The planes were officially described so far as unidentified in these messages, although later reports that have come in from the press associations definitely identify at least two of these planes as carrying the emblem of the rising sun, the emblem of Japan. The Pearl Harbor attack reported by KGMB in Honolulu is said to have been carried out in other messages by 50 to 100 planes, and a half an hour ago, it was said to be still continuing. The smoke of anti-aircraft guns rose over the Pearl Harbor Navy Yard. Heavy smoke also drifted up from Hickam Field in the Pearl Harbor area, apparently from fires, and witnesses said fires broke out on Ford Island. The main targets in this action by the Japanese appeared to be Hickman Field, which is the Army field, and the great naval base at Pearl Harbor, and several planes were reported shot down. Also, we've had a report from Honolulu that policemen and firemen were ordered in a radio broadcast to go to Army and Navy posts immediately. Major George Fielding Elliott, when this dispatch originally came in, pointed out that this may indicate that some of the Japanese resident in that area are being aids in this action by the Japanese against the shore areas. And the firemen and policemen may have been called up to stop any abortive revolutionary action in that area. Here's the first Associated Press dispatch from Honolulu. At least two Japanese bombers, their wings bearing the insignia of the rising sun, appeared over Honolulu at about 7:35 a.m. Honolulu time today and dropped bombs. As I told you a little earlier, these are the two planes of the reported 50 to 100, which have been definitely identified as wearing the insignia of the rising sun. Unverified reports said that a foreign warship appeared off Pearl Harbor and has begun firing at the defenses of that mighty fortified post. Reports also say that the Japanese bombers scored two hits, one at Hickman Field, Air Corps Post on Oahu Island, and the other at Pearl Harbor, which set an oil tank afire. American anti-aircraft has set up a terrific din, and the sky also is filled with American battle aircraft. We have just heard
that the Press Association dispatches, of course, are pouring in here. We've had a Washington bulletin received just a few minutes ago that disclosed an American Army transport, which was carrying lumber, was torpedoed 1,300 miles west of San Francisco. And we've just heard by telephone that Albert Warner in Washington has news of a State Department announcement. For that report from Albert Warner, we take you now to Washington.
A statement has just been issued now by the State Department from Secretary of State Cordell Hull. It runs as follows. On November 26th, the Secretary of State handed to the Japanese representatives a document which stated the principles which govern the policies of the government of the United States toward the situation in the Far East and setting forth principles for a comprehensive, peaceful settlement. At 1 p.m. today, this State Department statement continues, the Japanese ambassador asked for an appointment for the Japanese representatives to see the Secretary of State. The appointment was made for 1:45 p.m. The Japanese representatives arrived at 2:05 p.m. They were received by the Secretary of State at 2:20. The Japanese ambassador handed to the Secretary of State what was understood to be a reply to the American document of November 26th. Secretary of State Hull carefully read the statement presented by the Japanese representatives and immediately turned to the Japanese ambassador and with the greatest indignation said, I must say in all my conversations with you, the Japanese ambassador, and this is Secretary Hull speaking, I must say in all my conversations with you during the last 9 months, I have never uttered one word of untruth. And then Mr. Hull, referring to the Japanese note just handed to him, continued, in all my 50 years of public service, I have never seen a document that was so crowded with infamous distortions and falsehoods, on a scale so huge that I never imagined any government on this planet was capable of uttering them. The contents of the Japanese note is not given. Apparently, it follows the example set by Hitler in the case of his own aggressions, in which he charges the victim of aggression with all sorts of faults. And now we have word that Secretary of War Stimson has just issued an order to all military personnel in Washington and throughout the country to report for work Monday in uniform. Then from the White House comes word that the Army has received news of signals of distress believed to come from an Army cargo boat 700 miles west of San Francisco. Presumably, this is another ship. Previously, we had word from the White House that an Army transport carrying lumber was torpedoed 1,300 miles west of San Francisco. Now here are some of the first comments that we have gathered from congressmen. Veteran Senator Glass of Virginia says, I suppose that this means war. And ironically, he added, of course we're not going to surrender immediately without any effort to repel the attack. Senator Charles McNary, the Republican leader of the Senate, said, I am amazed at Japan. I thought they had better judgment. I deeply regret the turn of events. Now the nation must unite in giving her a beating for her stupidity and aggression. That was from Senator McNary. Senator Hill, the Democratic whip of the Senate, says this, the United States ought to use every means, every power to lick the Japanese, to lick them thoroughly and completely, and to do the job in the quickest possible time. Except for the bare announcements from the White House, there has been no further word. It's quite obvious that the American Navy and Air Force are taking counteraction against the Japanese. Once attacked, you do not stand on ceremony. The President has ample authority to send the Army and Navy into action when this country is attacked. Presumably, a naval blockade of Japan has already been ordered, and other hostilities than the Japanese air attacks will be reported. In a case of this kind, with open hostilities and the United States clearly the target of offensive action, it can be expected that the President will go before Congress. There he will explain what has taken place, and unless unofficial speculation is wrong, he will ask Congress for a declaration of war. There is no doubt what Congress would do. It has been notable all along that congressional sentiment is much more united on the subject of Japan than it has been on European developments.
But more than this, the United States itself is now the subject of definite attack. Let alone past sentiment, this would be enough to bring a united opinion in Congress. We return you now to New York.
That was Albert Warner's report from Washington on the latest developments in the Far Eastern situation with a report from the State Department. One mystery in connection with the announcement from Washington arose this afternoon when Ford Wilkins, the CBS correspondent in Manila, reported by telephone to Columbia at 3:30 o'clock that there had been no bombing of Manila. However, the INS has reported that the American naval base at Cafiti Island off Luzon was subjected to an enemy attack this morning. Army and Navy authorities commanded all forces to their stations and told them to resist the attack. There were no immediate reports on the damage. Now, Major George Fielding Elliott is here beside me again. And Major Elliott, we have a question which I believe needs answering. Do you see any grand strategy in these Japanese attacks upon the Hawaiian Islands and upon the Philippines?
The Philippines, and that refers particularly to the naval and air base of Manila, stands between Japan's home bases and the operations which she is conducting in Indochina. Therefore, the Japanese would like, of course, to eliminate this base if they possibly could. And it seems to me quite possible that the attacks on Hawaii are intended to cover a Japanese attack on the island of Luzon, and particularly directed at the naval and air base of Manila, in order to clear their lines of communication into the South China Sea, delay the arrival of the American fleet there. One interesting point is the fact that two apparently separate attacks by Japanese submarines upon American vessels between San Francisco and Honolulu have been reported. The Japanese have approximately 25 long-range submarines of the so-called I-50 class, which are capable of crossing the Pacific and returning without refueling. Apparently, therefore, these submarines, which would take about 10 to 12 days to get on that station from the nearest Japanese naval base, have been on their way for that length of time. And this throws a very curious light upon the Japanese request of a week ago for two additional weeks of negotiation. All this planning, all these attacks have been prepared over a long period of time. Certainly at least 2 weeks has elapsed since the original Japanese decisions were taken because of the location of the ships and comparatively slow ships such as submarines on this line of communications. One more item which may be of interest. We have just been informed here officially that the present reaction of the British government is officially this: to call attention to the Prime Minister's statement in his speech in the House of Commons some time ago that Great Britain would be at war with Japan 1 hour after Japan attacked the United States.
And now you've heard Mr. Warner's report of the War Department order in Washington ordering all military personnel in this country into uniform. The Army's order affected not only the thousands of officers on duty in Washington who have thus far performed their functions in civilian clothes to avoid a militaristic appearance, but all officers in every core area, the United States possessions and outlying bases. And here is a bulletin that has just come in from the press associations, datelined Los Angeles. Rear Admiral Charles H. Blakely broadcast an order today for all officers and men attached to the 11th Naval District to report to their ships or stations immediately. Washington is expected to blossom out tomorrow as a city of uniforms because huge numbers of officers have been pouring into the city for months to perform the Army's overhead functions. Early said that so far as the President's information went, attacks were still in progress at Manila and in Hawaii. That is, of course, Stephen Early, Presidential Press Secretary. In other words, he said, we don't know that the Japanese have bombed and left. He went on to say, as soon as the information of the attacks on Manila and Hawaii was received by the War and Navy Departments, it was flashed immediately to the President at the White House. Thereupon, and immediately, the President directed the Army and the Navy to execute all previously prepared orders looking to the defense of the United States. The President is now with the Secretaries of Navy and War, and steps are being taken to advise the congressional leaders. Also, we received a report earlier from Washington that any news of the Far Eastern developments would have to come from the White House. Navy officials, when queried for news, made that statement. Congressional leaders immediately were advised of the crisis, too. Attachés of the Japanese embassy began burning secret documents in the embassy yard. And a group of newspaper reporters and photographers stood by, watching. And after a few minutes, they were ordered to leave. The embassy doors were closed. There was no disorder. Columbia, of course, will interrupt any of its regularly scheduled programs to bring you bulletins and important developments on the news from the Far East
as it develops in Washington, and as we receive reports from our correspondents, the press associations and affiliated stations in the from the danger zone. W.L. Shira will be on the air at 5:45 over most of these stations. John Daly speaking.
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
WCCO Minneapolis. The United Press announces that it is ordering into operation on a 24-hour schedule all of its leased wire circuits throughout the country. The order was given to the American Telephone and Telegraph Company shortly after 2 p.m. to see that all newspaper and radio clients of the United Press, regardless of their normal hours of service, were hooked into the UP wire system immediately for continuing service until further notice. Now we take you back to the symphony concert by the New York Philharmonic Symphony Society.
And finally, back on NBC, just after 4 o'clock Eastern Time, a music program was interrupted by a telephoned report from affiliate KGU in Honolulu, Hawaii, while the attack was still continuing. It was captured on a low-quality paper record by an NBC engineer.
Richard Dyer Bennett, Sector Contribute. We interrupt this program to bring you a special broadcast.
Here's the bulletin. Washington. The president decided today, after Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor and Manila, to call an extraordinary meeting of the cabinet for 8:30 p.m. tonight, and to have congressional leaders of both parties join the conference at 9 p.m. And now we take you to Honolulu. Moment, please.
1234, hello NBC, this is KGU in Honolulu, Hawaii. They are speaking from the roof of the Advertiser Publishing Company building. We have witnessed this morning the distant view of battle off Pearl Harbor and a severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by enemy planes, undoubtedly Japanese. The city of Honolulu has also been attacked and considerable damage done. This battle has been going on for nearly 3 hours. One of the bombs dropped within 50 feet of KGU Tower. It is no joke. It is the real war. The public of Honolulu has been advised to keep in their homes and await results from the Army and Navy. There has been fierce fighting going on in the air and on the sea. The heavy shooting seems to be just a moment, no interruption.
The sounds of the afternoon of the 7th of December, 1941. That concludes this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. This program was an independent production by Doll Shoe Radio Creations, copyright 2005. Produced in the studios of WLSU La Crosse, an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio on the La Crosse campus of the University of Wisconsin. I'm King David McKenzie. Thanks for listening. I hope that you'll join us again at the same time next week. Until then, remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space.